And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
35 years ago around the United States, the first Earth Day was held, and millions of people rallied then to protect the Earth. The issues then were amazingly similar to those now, as we hear the debate about oil, about wilderness, forests, and water. But there are some enormous differences. Today, we explore the status of planet Earth and how the movement to preserve Mother Earth is now widely recognized as a struggle for survival with some enormous differences. You are in for some amazing news when we return with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Happy Earth Day! It's hard, and to some, somewhat painful to admit, that Earth Day is 35 years old. Many of you listening grew up learning about Earth Day in grade school. And many of you were there during Earth Day 1. I was, as a biologist, student, and naturalist. And it was great news then, an exciting and yet challenging time. Earth Day grew from an idea that Senator Gaylord Nelson from Wisconsin had back in 1962. He noticed a lot of passion for the land, the forests, the wildlife, but very little in his fellow legislators in Washington. He brought his concern to the White House and got as far as Robert Kennedy, the president's brother, who liked the idea. In September 1963, President Kennedy went on a five-day tour to bring attention to the Earth, but his efforts died with him a few months later. In 1969, during one of the most divisive years of the Vietnam War, Senator Nelson noted the teach-ins that were occurring on campuses across America, and he envisioned a similar event for the Earth. A public announcement and a few timely articles launched a passion for the idea on campuses around the country. With Dennis Hayes brought in to organize the event, April 22, 1970, lives now as a day that the environmental movement was launched into the American psyche. 2 years later, the message of limits was brought home as Americans queued up in endless lines creeping along to the gas pump. The oil embargo brought home the effect oil and the lack of oil could have on America's security. In the last 35 years, much has changed due to those early awakenings to the Earth and our relationship with it. Earth Day was above all else about health, because we all know without health, life is diminished. The message that a healthy environment translates directly into the possibility of a healthy life, that message keeps appearing every day of our lives. We now understand that toxins in our air, whether they be from chimneys or cigarettes, will hurt us. We know that chemicals in our drinking water can affect our health, our children, directly. We know that dumping chemicals onto the land can have huge consequences for those who then live in that environment. We are beginning to really understand that things that hurt the environment when compounded can have catastrophic effects. As we witness the depletion of our oceans, the changes in our weather, the literal rising of the Earth's oceans due to our continued use of oil for our energy and transportation, Earth Day 35 suddenly takes on great significance. To many of us, we wonder, how is it that we find ourselves still struggling over some of the same issues? As we speak, the House is debating the President's energy bill, a bill that is offering billions of dollars of tax breaks to the oil industry to create an even greater dependence on oil, and to many, thereby literally threatening our national security. It's difficult for many, including now increasing numbers within his own party, to understand why. The causes are many. To help us understand the real roots of this dilemma, I'm going to take us back in time. The year is 1992. A presidential campaign is being waged between the president's father, then President George Herbert Walker Bush, and the young firebrand from Arkansas, Bill Clinton. At the forefront of the effort to defeat the young governor was the newly emerged spokesman for the new right, none other than Rush Limbaugh. Here is a clip from the Rush Limbaugh show in which Rush is telling his audience the way it is when it comes to the environment.
The environmentalist wackos are at it again. It's a recurring theme. You think that you've beaten them back. You think that you have pummeled them into dormancy, and they surface again on you. And so it has happened again. There's a major, major conference of science. So here we go again, folks. The American Association for the Advancement of Science has found this. The Earth's land, water, and cropland are all disappearing. And that's not all. There's even worse news. If we don't slash world population from 5.5 billion to 2 billion or fewer by the year 2100, we're all dead. We've got 5 billion people in the world now. Do we not? 5 billion people. Now, the population projections are that we're going to have even more people by the year 2100. But whatever number we have more than today, let's say we add another billion just for the hell of it. I would probably be more than that, but let's say we do. Let's say it's 6 billion. Keep these, since most of the American people are stupid, as it has been postulated on this show, let's use simple numbers. We got 6 billion people living on the Earth in 2100. But we can't have that many. We can only have 2 billion. The Earth can only support 2 billion people in the future because it's going to run out of water, fossil fuels, cropland, all of that. The guy who's in charge of this is a guy named David Pimentel, and he's an ecologist at Cornell. And he says if the world's current population trends continue, we face a worldwide scenario. Now, here he goes. This is his words. Absolute misery, poverty, disease, and starvation. He furthermore states, quote, there is no way out of it. There are just insufficient resources for these people of the future to live like we do today. There are no technological solutions to be found. We can never replace fossil fuel. I take you back to 1968, the population bomb, Dr. Paul Ehrlich. Not one claim, not one prediction was even close to true. Not one prediction made in that book, and they were as dire as this guy's predictions. And not one of them has even come close to being borne out. I would like to make this counter statement, opinion as fact. I'll bet you I can find another scientist out there who will state that this world could support 15 billion people. That this world could support 20 billion people. Because I'm going to tell you something, folks. We don't have a shortage of resources. Listen very carefully. We do not have a shortage of resources. The people who predicted the Earth couldn't stand 1 billion people were wrong. There were people who said we couldn't support 2 billion people. They said we couldn't support 3. We're supporting 5 billion people, and we can support 3 times this much. This population scare is just the next crisis. Everything's over. It's time to cash in the chips and check out. Let me give you a little fact. Tell you what the facts of this thing are. You could take the entire population of the world today, group them as though they were families of four, and put them in 1,500 square foot homes. And you could fit all those homes inside a geographic area the size of the state of Texas. These are mathematic figures. These are scientific calculations. This is not somebody guessing, not somebody's opinion. Now, let me ask you this. If the world's population lived in Texas, do you think there'd be any starvation? There would not be. You know why? Because there's capitalism in the United States. Our problem is not a shortage of resources. Our problem is not the unequal distribution of resources. Our problem, as I so state in my first book, The Way Things Ought to Be, our problem is the unequal distribution of capitalism. And once again, look at what the environmental wacko's solution to their imagined crisis is. A rollback of lifestyles to the days of poverty for all. Peasantry for all. to roll back civilized advances so that we all are nothing more than the equivalent of those living in the frozen tundra of the great Northeast in the 1400s, or even further. And it's not necessary. You couple that with Vice President Al Gore saying the automobile is the single biggest threat to mankind that we've ever had. This is why the guys can say they're scientists and all this, but they cannot make these predictions because every prediction in the past about what an explosion of people and population this planet would cause to happen have not even come close to the mark. In fact, we haven't begun, my friends, to tap the resources at this planet. Look at trees. We got more trees now than we had when we signed the Declaration of Independence. Well, that's not supposed to be. It's supposed to be destroying all this forest land. It's all just hocus-pocus, typical liberal scare-mongering and crisis creation. We'll be back with more of your calls after this.
Amazingly, 13 years later, both Rush and Bush are still on message. But the wacko environmental nuts have been vindicated. We now live in the world of the end of oil, the consequences of overpopulation, and most dramatically, the emergence of a consumer-driven Chinese economy that, well, threatens our very existence. It's easy to understand how we are where we are when we realize that that message has been hammered out into the American public every single day since then. The environmental movement has been demonized, pilloried, attacked, and diminished in order to support the unlimited exploitation of resources that Rush and those who made him glorified as the raison d'etre of an unfettered capitalist dream. Earth Day 35 is dedicated to protect our children and our future. Today, we embrace the theme, and as you will see, bring new meaning to that concept. To all of you who have celebrated each Earth Day from its beginning, I say, we have won the debate. All that we have championed has been right all along, and we need now to shake off all the slime and sludge that has been flung at us every day, emerge fresh, new, clean, and knowing that we were right all along, and now unite for the challenge ahead, for the challenges are now in our face due to the childishness of the likes of Limbaugh and his ditto heads. In truth, they are becoming inconsequential. Now we must celebrate the insight, truth, and wisdom, and the freedom to unite, knowing the challenges before us. To those who still dally, I quote a proverb written just for you, perhaps thousands of years ago. If you don't change your course, you may end up where you're going. For the rest of us, celebrate the glory of our struggle. Unite in our human mission to save ourselves as well as our planet Earth. For the future of our economy relies on a new energy future. In a moment, we return with a clear message about America's national security from a man whose job it was to protect it in the real world of power. Your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Everyone listening knows the price that America is paying now, literally, for ignoring the Earth Day messages over the past 35 years. Oil is running out. And with that comes the enormous jump in the price of gas. It seems somehow some of our politicians wish to play with America's security. But the voices of many now are uniting in amazing new alliances to speak up about the need for a new American energy economy. This is now a matter of the gravest national security. Monday in Washington, D.C., there was a very amazing announcement by a coalition of people involved in the environment and security that normally don't come together and talk about the future of America's environment and energy independence, but they did. And what they are terming this new effort is the Re-Energize America campaign. And one of the key participants and promoters of this is Vice Admiral Dennis McGinn, USN, U.S. Navy retired, who is talking with us now. Are you in D.C.?
I am.
Tell us, first of all, about this event and how it came to be.
It came to be through the auspices of the Natural Resources Defense Council, who had been tracking this whole history of our growing energy dependence and was hearing voices from many, many different sections of society, many different organizations, not the traditional ones that you would think of in the past as being focused on energy and environment, and decided to put together a campaign called Re-Energize America to make sure that people understood that we were facing a national crisis that was growing every day and had aspects of threats to national security, to our economy, to our environment, and in some cases to our way of life.
Give us a broad spectrum about who actually was participating.
Well, we had in this particular event, the kickoff event, we had the Steelworkers of America represented. We had ranchers and, shall we say, stewards of the far west, where a lot of oil and gas exploration is conducted, represented by a sixth generation rancher from New Mexico. We had the evangelical movement represented by Reverend Jim Ball to make the case that this was really an issue of concern to those of faith, and I represented the position, if you will, on national security, the national security aspects of our growing dependence on oil.
Well, Admiral McGinn, you have at times in your life had a terrific amount of responsibility in terms of national security. Give us a brief background about your history.
Well, one of my most enjoyable and at the same time challenging roles was as commander of the U.S. Third Fleet, homeported right there in San Diego aboard the USS Coronado at the time. In that role, I was responsible for the readiness and training of Pacific Fleet carrier battle groups and expeditionary strike groups, and was very, very keenly aware of the kinds of challenges that our sailors and Marines working with their service counterparts might face in all areas of the world. As a result of that, I became very concerned about our growing dependence on oil from parts of the world that weren't very friendly to our core values in the United States. And then I started looking at some of the economic indicators. The tremendous growth of the economies of, in particular, China and in India, and also the growing demand that they had for this critical natural resource of oil.
Give us your assessment of our current situation.
Just briefly, it's we have about anywhere from 2 to 3% of the known world reserves of oil that are in the United States or United States territory. We use 25% of the world's oil that is produced. So this isn't a sustainable situation. If you add to that the fact that there's going to be more competition for oil resources over the next 5 to 10, 15 years, we have got to do something to ensure that we reduce our dependence on oil in general, but in particular on foreign imported oil, oil from unstable regions of the world.
What is the way forward then for America?
Basically, it's two major components. We can do so much better in terms of the value that we get from every unit of energy that we use. For example, fuel standards for our automobile and our trucking industry. We did tremendously well as a nation when we were faced with the crisis of oil shortages in the 1970s. We've increased our efficiency in terms of energy usage. At the same time, our economy grew. So it isn't a situation where we have to sacrifice our quality of life. We don't have to sacrifice our economy, the amount of jobs available to us in the challenge of increasing energy efficiency. In fact, by increasing energy efficiency, we can actually increase the robustness of our economy, increase more jobs, and maintain or increase our quality of life. A good example of this has to do with the transportation sector. This consumes about 60% of the energy that we import, and we can do so much better in terms of our choices of the the fuel consumption standards that our vehicles use, how we use our vehicles. One of the easiest way to think about this is a typical hybrid, a so-called hybrid automobile, for starters, will double the fuel consumption of an equivalent type of vehicle that is not hybrid. And if you go into the future in the next 5 to 10 years and we start seeing what are called plug-in hybrids and hybrids whose internal combustion engines can run on 85-15 ethanol gasoline mixes, you can get enormous energy efficiency out of every gallon of gasoline that you put into those vehicles. In our homes, we can do so much more. Most people are familiar with the Energy Star label. I think being selective as consumers in the types of appliances that we buy, how we heat and cool our homes, how we insulate them, we can maintain, as I said, a great quality of life. It isn't a great sacrifice. And the key point to remember here is that this is a pocketbook issue. For every extra dollar that we spend on fuel inefficiency in our cars or in kilowatt hours in our homes, that's money that could be used for so many other uses. And it just makes a lot of sense to make smart choices and ones that do not detract from our quality of life in the least.
You know, to a large extent, there are certainly the correlations to war, that this is a war. We really are struggling at this point to determine our future, and there are a lot of prices that we're paying. You're used to kind of rallying troops and getting them behind this. How do we actually then, therefore, bring this out to the American public to get them involved in this effort?
I think just making them aware of the fact that the choices that we make as Americans, making us all aware of the choices that we make, have a direct effect on our overall economy, and it's not necessarily in the long term, it can be in the very short term. Also, we should understand that when we import the large amount of oil that we do, that supply could be cut off at any time by a variety of circumstances. Of course, one of the most dramatic would be a terrorist attack on a major oil transshipment point overseas or major oil refining capability. That the consequences economically of that type of a disruption of our oil supply would be very, very dramatic indeed. We would find ourselves looking at gas prices of $2.25 a gallon with nostalgia, as the price per barrel of oil went up because of the greatly limited supply due to that disruption of oil and the continuing demand in this country as well as in other countries.
Now, assuming that that doesn't happen, and pray to God it never does, but if we don't actually then win this war into the future, what are the risks of failure to America?
Economic risk. Because every dollar that we spend on energy is a dollar that we're not investing. It's a consumption society. It isn't an investment society. It's a risk of national security in a traditional military sense, in that we make ourselves more and more vulnerable to being held hostage to disruption to the oil supply by some nation or group of nations that's hostile to our national purposes. And it's a threat to our environment. No matter whether you believe global warming is going to happen rapidly or happen in the far distant future, in very, very local ways, we all have experienced local smog, local air quality degrading. And I think that that is something that we all can do a much better job at solving by making better personal choices, just based on awareness of the fact that energy consumption really contributes to a variety of ills if we don't do it efficiently.
What kind of a time frame are we looking at to really start to see progress?
I think the time to make progress is literally right now. Every time that we make a decision to get a more efficient automobile or to use the automobiles we have in a more efficient way, it contributes to the solution. I think looking at things like renewable energy sources, becoming aware of things, it's a fancy term, but it's simple in its concept, renewable portfolio standards. That's simply a demand that can be placed on a utility company that a certain percentage of the electricity they supply to our homes comes from renewable sources like wind or biomass or photovoltaic, solar type of electricity. And that will increase the ability of the industry in the renewable energy area to meet some of this demand. We cannot, in the near term, expect to replace a huge amount of our fossil fuel energy requirements with renewables. But for every percent of energy that is produced for electricity or for transportation by renewables, that's 1% less that we are dependent on oil and dependent on foreign oil.
As you look out into the long term, 5, 10, 20 years, where do you see America's energy sources coming from at that point?
We will continue to use oil, but I see a greater proportion coming from renewables. I mentioned some of them, solar power, wind power. We've been doing hydroelectric power for many, many years. Biomass, bioethanol. There's a technology that is coming online now to use certain enzymes to be able to break down what were previously unusable parts of plant structures, that is, vegetation structures, to produce ethanol. And that's called cellulosic ethanol. And all of these renewable sources will be coming more and more into vogue and into availability for consumer choices. I think in the energy efficiency arena, we'll see much more progress in more energy efficient appliances under the Energy Star program. We'll see much greater use of such things as ground source heat pumps to heat and cool our homes. Better insulation, not just for the usual attic insulation or window insulation, but indeed the whole structure of homes. And I see a whole variety of technologies that aren't around the corner, but literally are here today, available to consumers, that will have an increasingly greater effect. One of the things, though, that we all should be aware of is that right now, as we speak, there is a debate going on in the House of Representatives in the U.S. Congress here in Washington, and it's about the energy bill. And one of the things that very, very greatly concerns me is there's about $3 billion of subsidies that are going to oil and gas companies in that bill that incentivizes exactly the wrong behavior. It's really important that our elected representatives in Congress stop incentivizing oil and gas companies that are making enormous profits at $55 a barrel oil from giving them tax incentives. Those tax incentives ought to be applied to the industries that are producing energy efficiency and renewable energy, energy from sources that are different than oils and natural gas sources. And I think that that is a great place to start in really, really turning the tide on our energy dependency. We were able to do tremendous things in the 1970s after the first oil embargo, and we can increase our performance, increase our energy efficiency, greatly increase our use of renewable energies if we have the right kind of national policy and the right kind of law.
In terms of the Defense Department itself and the vast defense expenditures, do you see movement there? Because there is that could be a leading edge in terms of creating some of these new technologies, really developing them.
Absolutely. The Department of Energy is getting increasingly active in this area of, in particular, energy efficiency, but also renewable energies. For example, there was a report that was published by the Rocky Mountain Institute in September of last year called Winning the Oil Endgame. It's a terrific report. It's available free online at rmi.org, and it basically tells us how over a period of 25 to 30 years that we can eliminate our dependence on oil and greatly increase our national security in the process. The Department of Defense funded over 50% of the cost of producing that report, and I think it's clear evidence that they are keenly interested in this aspect of national security.
Vice Admiral Dennis McGinn, I want to thank you so much for your voice. I tell you what, it's a refreshing, wonderful, positive, hopeful perspective, and I so much thank you for sharing that on the Wild Side News.
Thank you. We can meet this challenge. We just need to become aware of what the great tools that are available to do it, and we can win this, America.
Let's win it.
Take care.
Thanks so much. There is no more pressing national security issue for America and ultimately the world than quickly and collectively developing a world that lives on renewable energy. Wow, that sounds so much like an Earth Day message. We just won the debate. When we return, we look at the new alliances and invite you to join those of us who are enlisting in the new energy war to win the battle to energy self-reliance. Here on the Wild Side News. Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith. Over the past few months, the Wild Side News has presented a big picture of the new players in this new energy vision. You're up to date about the state of the oceans. You've been introduced to a solar technology that can change the world. You've been introduced to the captains of the clean tech movement. And when you head on into the archives, you see the amazing friends of all that Earth Day 35 represents. When we return, we put it all together. So get ready for the real New World Order marching towards peace and stability and a healthy, hope-filled world for us all here on the Wild Side News. This 35th anniversary of the first Earth Day is the beginning of a whole new vision. To a very large extent, we all really get it. Most everyone loves our land and the wild creatures. We value clean air and clear vistas for our visions to roam. We want to get along with our neighbors and with the world. Let's be honest. What is most encouraging is that America is united now for our own good, to get to work, to invest, to build, to reconstruct, to invent and forge a new American dream. It has come together, and it will serve us all so well. So, to celebrate this moment, I want to bring us all some of the voices of the Earth that have helped to make this all possible. So now, from the Voice of the Earth on the Wild Side News, a tribute to wisdom.
Hello, everyone. We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, and I might start with, what is it? What it is really kind of takes an arrow back to Senator Mathias and what he did. He established a bipartisan effort to create a vision that would really preserve sections of land that are so powerful and that we have for years and years and years been using them kind of like slogans for how we identify the best of ourselves. And the beauty and the power of our natural places has always held a kind of symbolic place for Americans. So we should be protecting these areas for future generations to preserve something that really does bind us together. What that something is the love of our country's incomparable public land. What we do preserve as much as what we develop is going to define us as a people and really basically as a society in perpetuity.
Kathleen Rogers, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you so much.
I want to invite you to greet our listeners and share your thoughts for this very special Earth Day 2004.
Well, I'm very happy to be on, and thank you so much for inviting me. It's a very exciting day, and I think your listeners can be proud of the fact that as environmentalists or as people who care about the Earth, they are joining together today with at least 500 million to 600 million people who are also participating in Earth Day in over 170 countries.
What happens on a river cleanup?
It can be anything as from a small group doing a shoreline along a, you know, parking lot of a campground or something, and then we have other groups who actually get in the water in canoes and rafts and pull just about anything that's not supposed to be there. They try to pull back out tires, paper cups, tin cans, that sort of thing. And we send them tips on how to organize their cleanup, safety tips, press releases on how to get press for it so they can turn out some more volunteers. And we really don't dictate how they should conduct their cleanup, but we try to guide them along with what they need to do.
Hot's been there for me. I've had, you know, a couple bad weeks where I couldn't do anything just because of pain levels, and he would sit right there by my side. He's almost gotten to the point where he can anticipate my needs, even when I'm, you know, physically down and unable to do much. You know, if I want to go to the refrigerator to get something out for supper, he knows that that's where I'm headed, and he opens that door for me. We get out and I'm getting tired or something, he moves just a little bit closer and positions himself so I can grab his harness, you know, like he's ready for me to pull, or for him to pull me. He's bonded with me much more than I ever thought was possible.
One British captain, a Captain Codrington, actually said, he predicted, there will be many busted heads in Baltimore before nightfall. And I think that shows the attitude of at least some of the British officers involved in this. The British ships got within range of the fort's guns. One eyewitness said it sounded like thunder when the fort's cannons fired. They were fired in such rapid succession.
Wow.
And the Baltimoreans went on the rooftops. We have a lot of letters, people saying that they were on the roof of the Holiday Street Theater, which is today City Hall. We also have letters of other people squirming out, you know, and climbing on the rooftops. And they said you could see the smoke curling up over the fort and the flashes of the fort's guns in the midst of the smoke.
Vince?
And, yeah.
Boy, do you like your work?
Just a little bit. No, I love my work.
I know. It's so obvious.
I love my work.
You're a fabulous interpreter. And we didn't even have a chance to really talk about the rest of the park. But I'll tell you what, Vince is the best invitation to visit Fort McHenry in Maryland that I can imagine.
Well, American Hiking Society was formed in 1977 to be a national voice for America's hikers. And then as a part of our outreach in promoting and protecting foot trails and the hiking experience, 12 years ago we joined up with several key partners on the federal side, the National Park Service, the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, and West Backpacker Magazine to launch National Trails Day. And then very shortly thereafter, Thorlow Fox came in as well to support this program. And what it is a national celebration of trails all across the country. And actually, we have events in every single state, one in Canada and three in Puerto Rico.
This is one of the most innovative, boundary-busting, and hope-filled realities for every person, and animal, and vista, and community, and nation on the planet. And here to tell you about it is one of the principals in the new hydrogen car company, Cole Freitas. Cole, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Cindy.
Let's lay it on the table here. You say you have a hydrogen-powered car. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, we have more than one car. And what we did is we announced several weeks ago that we had we are making available for sale Shelby Cobras that run off a hydrogen internal combustion engine. And those are for wealthy individuals, high-end users, celebrities, people who will get a lot of visibility. And we partnered up with Carroll Shelby to make those cars. But we also offer pickup trucks that are F-150s and Rangers that also run off internal combustion engines using hydrogen that are much more affordable and that are comparable or a little bit more expensive than F-150s and Rangers that are new and run off gasoline.
Really only 13% of the NPRA, which was the compromise that was worked out. Why is that so important in terms of this area?
Well, just to highlight a few of the features, this area has very high-density nesting populations of red-throated loons, the rare yellow-billed loon, common eiders, king eiders, long-tailed ducks, a number of shorebird species, and also populations of the threatened spectacle eider. This is a species that's actually listed under the Endangered Species Act as threatened. So those are birds that nest there. And then in the after breeding season, geese and many waterfowls molt their feathers, and when their wing feathers molt, they are actually flightless. And during that period of time, in July and a portion of August, these birds are very, very sensitive to any disturbance. They're very vulnerable because they can't fly. So they seek out the most valuable wetland complexes that have abundant food and low densities of predators and are very secluded. So the Teshikpuk Lake, and particularly the deep water lakes just north of Teshikpuk, between Teshikpuk Lake and the Arctic Ocean, that area is a very high value for molting geese, and is considered by most scientists as one of the most significant goose molting areas in the entire circumpolar Arctic.
Pale male, you look into his eyes and you get hooked. He's an animal, he's a bird, he's a hero. You look at him, you realize this is someone true, man. This is not some celebrity who would, you know, fool around with some prostitute somewhere and disappoint you somewhere. This is a bird, it's real. You look at him, you know there's no disappointment to come. He is a true hero. He's not a politician. He does his thing, you watch him, and you feel good deep inside of your heart. He is my hero. That is how I spend so much time on him. I take all my vacation I have. I just practically took time off from work indefinitely until this stuff is resolved. That's the kind of effect he has on me.
I think I'm going to start off by giving you a greeting in chimpanzee. That really means just, hello, I'm Jane. You know, that's how they greet the morning.
The king of Bhutan, because leadership, radical leadership, radical, intelligent, caring leadership is required. Talk about that wonderful story.
Well, the Bhutanese looked around at the world, and they're sandwiched between China and India, two of the biggest countries in the world, and the king of Bhutan, who was an absolute ruler, decided that A, he was going to give up his absolute power, which he did, and established a parliament, and they all got together, and it's an educated, by the way, it's their top educated people, they're not ignoramuses. The king of Bhutan is 10 times as smart as George Bush and 10 times as well educated. Said, we're going to not go for gross national product alone, we're going to go for gross national happiness. We're going to preserve our forests, we're going to preserve our culture, and the diversity of cultures is one of the wonders of humanity, and we're going to work at making our people all happy, healthy, well cared for, and in a wonderful environment. Whether they'll totally succeed or not is still an issue. They let TV in, which may have been a big mistake.
Floresta was founded about 20 years ago by a group of Americans and Dominicans who had been working together doing hurricane relief following Hurricane David. And they became frustrated in giving out basically food aid and handouts day in and day out without addressing any of the root causes. So they decided to dig a little deeper and see why people were unable to make a living for themselves. And came to the very interesting conclusion, and it's especially interesting when you consider kind of who these people were and the presuppositions they went in with, but they came to the conclusion that deforestation was one of the key causes, one of the root causes of rural poverty in the Dominican Republic.
My sermon this morning is captioned, God's Love in Nature. And I want you to journey with me this morning back into time, a time called the beginning. An earth with a sound ecological system, well-balanced ecosystem, clean, pure environment. Yes, that was paradise. Oh, my friends, I could imagine all the Amazonas, every species in those days, none were extinct. As they beautified, as they adorned the foliage or the flora with their lovely plumage, oh, what a sight! Praise be to God!
And in 1991, I went to a Greenpeace rally for whales in Trafalgar Square. I was invited to be one of a group of celebrity speakers. And I was given a piece to talk about long-range communication of whales across oceans and across many thousands of miles. And I was astonished at that because I had no idea that whales did. Could do all these things. I, unlike a lot of people, had never heard the whale record, and because I think I was too busy doing Shakespeare or something at the time. But anyway, Roger Payne opened this rally for whales, and we met there at the rally, and we were married 10 weeks later. And when I met Roger, I remember writing that it was like standing on the shores of an ocean, and the waves just rolling in, and somehow. I knew that I was encountering and finally embracing a much bigger world than just the world of theatrical and film and television acting that I'd been involved with.
The indigenous people have had such a tremendous impact on me, as you know from my other 5 books, which are all about them. And without their help, without having seen it from their side, I don't think I ever would have had the courage to write this book, and I don't think I ever would have had the heart to write the book, or the hope. The book is written out of a great sense of hope. When I wrote this book, I knew I was sticking my neck in a noose, and not suicidal or self-destructive. So I would only stick my neck in a noose if I had great hope that it was going to accomplish something positive. And the indigenous people, with all of their prophecies, from so many different cultures, as I talk about in the book, they all prophesy. So many cultures prophesy that we've entered a time of potential for tremendous transition for human beings to rise to a new level of consciousness and relate to each other and the environment in very different ways. And I have complete hope that we will do that. And I realize that has to start by a true recognition of where we've come from and where we stand right now today. And part of that recognition involves recognizing what economic hitmen have done, what we've all done, in essence, to create this empire.
Now let's bring it down to people. What in the world can they do to become part of this process?
I think between the scientific community, the aquarium, communicators, perhaps this New Earth Observing System will be able to put part of this continuous picture of this continuous diagnosis of the ocean onto the Internet. I think actually the Internet may be a tool for creating the globally connected behavior that we will need in order to arrive at a management of a global problem.
Well, I'm going to give you the opportunity to talk to the whole world and tell them your thoughts about what is most critical in the years ahead.
The solving the global environmental issues that we see gradually accumulating will require a degree of human cooperation and interconnectedness that has not yet been seen.
We're working on it.
So are we.
Connect up brains, hearts, and hold hands, and then indeed we can look forward to a better and a more peaceful future if we help each other, if we maintain hope. So that's the message I have for you. Never give up. There's always hope. Thanks.
I want to thank all of you for tuning in and joining in. We can look back on this 35-year struggle and know that we have been on message and right all along. Now we need to unite and move our planet forward for us, for our children, and for this magical mystery tour of life on our great little planet Earth. So until next time, or any time on the archives, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again on your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.